So first of all, I have no slides. Okay, so just look at me. There we go. Second of all, there are themes, there's a theme throughout a number of the talks recently about how science is as much a byproduct of luck. And I'll add to that theme. I almost became a synthetic organic chemist. In fact, the chemicals that Bruce talked about, the thiazolidine diones, the ones that took me a long time to pronounce just now, were ones that I was working on as an undergraduate at Harvard in David Evans's lab, trying to design stereospecific chemical reactions to make those pharmaceutical agents. So I inadvertently contributed to the obesogen effect of a pharmaceutical, just as an aside. Now, the reason that I'm here is not that I worked on that. I didn't have lab hands, first of all, so I didn't have that needed skill to transform my career down to the bench science the way Bruce and others do. And I enjoyed talking to people a bit more, I'll admit. So I decided to go down the career of clinical medicine, and I became a pediatrician. That doesn't tell you how I got into endocrine disruption. It doesn't tell you a darn thing about how I got into environmental health, because the average medical student gets only 4 hours of environmental health training in their entire 4 years. I can tell you stories of how I held retractors for heart and abdominal surgeries for 7 or 8 hours at a time and cut stitches too short, too long, too short, too long. But anyway, sorry, it's just too many memories. But suffice it to say that the way I got into environmental health is through the lens of health policy. I applied to medical school during the Clinton healthcare plan dialogue. I was tired of getting all these questions about what I thought about the so-called Hillary Clinton healthcare plan with the card. You may remember that, some of you, at the State of the Union. And I at one point asked, so what does medical school teach you to understand healthcare delivery systems? And I got a blank stare from my interviewer. I think I got into that medical school somehow. But suffice it to say, that set in motion a series of steps. I decided to get a master's in public policy and medical degree. Let me accelerate a little bit and just say that master's year between my third and fourth year of medical school transformed me into wanting to do health policy as my career. I did my pediatric residency barely. I almost wanted to go work in DC instead and went to go work for Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton after residency. And I was told, you can work on children's health, but we also want you to work on environmental health issues. And I said, okay, I can handle it. Well, let's just say that year from 2002 to 2003 was fundamentally transformative in my career and set me up on doing what I do today. So, as a pediatrician, I almost actually didn't get here because I was in clinic Wednesday morning and had to catch a 1 o'clock flight as opposed to a 12 o'clock flight. And that was just when the thunder snow was hitting New York City. But the reason I bring that up is that I can't tell you which patients in my primary care clinic had endocrine disruptor effects. I can just tell you that the effects are there. So why? We've talked a lot about laboratory studies showing effects on obesity. We haven't talked as much, arguably, about chemical effects on the developing brains of children. We've talked about anogenital distance. We've talked about infertility. There's a theme there, though, in the anogenital distance, the IQ score that we measure in children, and the body mass index shifts that we see in populations that produce obesity. And that a lot of the effects we're talking about fly under that clinical radar. There's not one person who has imprinted on their forehead in the pediatric clinic phthalate syndrome, for example. I wish that were the case. I don't talk about phthalate syndrome as a diagnostic criteria when I bring kids into the primary care clinic. Only over the past few years I've intentionally inserted it into my teaching of residents just because it's urgently needed and still, despite my own efforts at NYU, not a major part of the conventional medical curriculum. But I can tell you that if a child comes back from school with one less IQ point as a result of an endocrine disruptor or some other exposure, maybe the parent might notice, maybe the pediatrician might notice, maybe the school teacher might notice, but the entire economy notices. And that's the theme of a whole track of work that I do. And Adam Smith, the father of modern economics, would be rolling over in his grave about what's going on, because environmental health hazards induce what are called market externalities. They actually induce the dysfunction of market economies. They lead to overproduction of chemicals from deviating from the societally optimal amount, and chemicals are produced more cheaply at a lower cost than the proper price. They're actually mispriced. So you have a situation where markets are not properly functioning because chemical factors are affecting people who are outside the market transaction, if you will. They're not buying or selling a product, but they're the innocent bystanders of the various hit and run accidents that occur as a result of chemical exposure across the lifespan. So now you'll ask me how much, and you may also ask how much is too much, but let's focus on how much. So with regard to endocrine disrupting chemicals, the difficulty is that it's a relatively new field. I mean, the DES story really set, and Rachel Carson, happy International Women's Day, by the way, we've set the stage. Pete's work, a bunch of people, I stand on the shoulders of many giants here today. Let's just put it that way. But suffice it to say that this is a 30-year max field with regard to the steepness of the learning curve that we're seeing today. There's so much we've learned so quickly. And yes, it's mostly from the laboratory, but there are human studies that are increasingly suggesting effects. And it's amazing we're detecting these effects in humans because of the many other factors that are contributing to these diseases in the first place. And you can't run a randomized controlled trial on humans of endocrine disrupting chemicals in general. It's just ethically not appropriate to have a pregnant woman say, ah, and take a pesticide, for example. No institutional review board worth its wits would actually go ahead and do that. So what do we have to do? We have to take the evidence as it is from the laboratory and from humans, and we have to come up with an estimate of the probability of causation. So we put together a series of five expert panels back in 2013 and 2014. It's amazing to think it was that long ago we were in Paris. But many of you in this room were actually part of that effort. And we focused on the areas for which the evidence was strongest with regard to effects on across the life course. We looked at brain development. We looked at obesity and diabetes. We looked at male reproductive effects. We looked at female reproductive effects. We looked at cancers. And we picked the chemicals for which the evidence was the strongest. We only looked at less than 5% of endocrine disrupting chemicals, by the way. We had a limited amount of time. We really were doing this on a series of shoestring budgets with I'm not minimizing the support we got from another number of private foundations who are crucial in the process. And we ended up finding 15 exposure outcome relationships, combinations of a chemical exposure and the disease outcome that it caused, and found surprisingly strong evidence from the laboratory and humans to suggest an effect. We then extrapolated disease burdens and costs for each of them. And then we did an extra step to be super conservative. We downgraded all the cost numbers based on the probability of causation. If there was a 1 in 3 chance, in general, we cut it down, the cost down by a third, because there's only a 1/3 chance. You're only gonna roll, you know, a six-sided die with a 1 or 2, 2 out of every 6 times, right? And there may be a cost, there may not be a cost. There's uncertainties. So we downgraded the cost for the uncertainties. And then we added up all the costs across these 15 exposure outcome relationships. And yet, despite the fact that we're looking at less than 5% of endocrine disrupting chemicals, a subset of diseases due to those endocrine disrupting chemicals, and a subset of costs due to those endocrine disrupting chemicals, we only use peer-reviewed, published, direct measurements of costs medical care. There's some downstream effects on education we're able to capture, but we weren't able to capture human suffering and some of the costs that people would readily apply to some of the diseases that we added up. And we found first in Europe that the costs were 163 billion euro. That's $209 billion in the United States, 1.2% of Europe's GDP. The reason we did it in Europe first is that, much like what Pete said yesterday, Europe has been ahead of the game on this. And so we focused on Europe because we knew that we could do the most in Europe in terms of translating our findings right away. 1.2% of GDP. And that's an underestimate of an underestimate of an underestimate. Then we moved over to the United States context. $340 billion. Now, mind you, these are annual costs insofar as exposures continue at their current levels. 2% of GDP each year. And what's interesting here about those two numbers, they differ, but there's some good news and some bad news. Let's try the good news first. Good policies prevent exposures, they reduce disease, and they save money. In the United States, back in 1993, the Food Quality Protection Act inserted intentionally an additional safety factor to protect kids. As a result of that, we have in the US much lower levels of pesticides, organophosphate pesticides, as measured in kids and moms' urines compared to folks in Europe. You compare the dollar numbers roughly, it's $40 billion of cost in the United States. It's nearly approaching 80% of the cost in Europe, 160 or so billion of costs due to organophosphate pesticides as a result of children losing crucial moments of brain development and not developing optimally from the perspective of their cognitive potential. The bad news is that we messed it up for flame retardants. California law, TB 117, since the 70s, has required until 2013 flame retardants to be sprayed in every conceivable piece of furniture that's sold in the United States today. So you measure the average American PBDE level, it's the 95th percentile in Europe as a given. So the bad news here is the cost of PBDEs in the United States is about $282 billion. The cost in Europe is more like that $40 billion number I estimated. So again, policies produce exposures, exposures produce disease, and disease is costly. Now, someone from a banking background or an industry background will say, hey, wait a minute, what are the costs of actually preventing? Let's have a proper trade-off. And I say, I'm game for that. Okay, mind you that the costs of interventions, of safer alternatives, automatically reduce as you set the market up to innovate, by the way. But let's just take the numbers as they are as a given. Let's take bisphenol A, for example. Bisphenol A, assuming it's used in all aluminum cans, though we saw data suggesting otherwise with time, is used in 100 billion aluminum cans a year. There's a safer alternative called oleoresin. I'm not sure it's perfectly safe, but it costs 2.2 cents more a can. 100 billion, 2.2 cents, you do the math, it's $2.2 billion of costs. So what are the potential benefits? Well, there are a number of studies, not all of them are perfect, that suggest that you can reduce your BPA level by getting BPA out of aluminum cans by roughly 66%. That's a single estimate. It's based on a single study, so there are some limitations to this extrapolation. So we ran a hypothetical. We took the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's data from national surveys on BPA levels in urine, and we hypothetically reduced everyone by 66% instantaneously. Before we did that, for childhood obesity and adult cardiovascular disease, the costs of BPA were about $3 billion. Mind you, that's only two of the diseases associated with BPA, so let's just recognize the limitations there. You reduce BPA by 66%, you take away $1.7 billion in costs. So you save $1.7 billion at the societal level, and I just told you it costs $2.2 billion to do that. And I'm only measuring two potential benefits of that regulatory action. So, like, and mind you, we did sensitivity analyses and some alternative assumptions in our models to suggest that actually it could be a six-fold benefit. The benefits could actually be as high as $14 billion. So, I'm a realist, okay? At the same time, I'm not expecting FDA to spontaneously phase out the use of BPA in aluminum cans. If you look at the press release about the most recent BPA clarity study that only described half of the data from the FDA, wasn't peer-reviewed, et cetera, but yet still published and promulgated as BPA being safe, you'll know that that's not likely to come anytime soon. Same might be said for EPA. We've already heard enough about that with regard to many of the chemicals that we're talking about. But there, first of all, some safe and simple steps that we can take to limit our exposure. Reducing our canned food consumption, eating organic, avoiding the spraying of pesticides, avoiding microwaving plastics, avoiding machine dishwashing plastics that can etch and scratch the plastic such that the coating allows for more leaching of phthalates into food. And we know that intervention studies reduce levels of these chemicals, even in low-income populations. A California study in a farming population saw organic food intervention successfully reduce pesticide levels by 60%, the same percentage that it was decreased in the high-income population that had been studied at Emory about a decade earlier. So we know that interventions work. Now, that's at home. The final challenge that we have, and probably the biggest challenge that we have to do, is that we're only in our homes how many hours a day? We're at a conference today, we're probably in our work lives 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. Might not seem that easy to control our work environment, right? Our cars, our subways, our buses, all those different environments that we can influence. Well, I'm not so convinced about that. Look at what we did about BPA-free in bottles. I'm not saying BPA-free is perfect. BPS, BPF, BPAP, the band of artists formerly known as bisphenol A, are all around to stay, unfortunately, and speak to the regrettable substitution crisis. It's a big problem. But we at least move the needle by speaking out. Companies listen. And if you think individual consumers can't move the needle of these manufacturers, think about what bigger corporations, universities, institutions like FIPS can do through their own corporate purchasing. I would argue they can actually do more than we can do as individuals, and I look how much we've done as individuals. So I come away in the end, as much as Adam Smith is rolling over in his grave, as much as I've given you dire consequences for costs and consequences of endocrine disruption, I have a lot of hope. And then you can align the economic forces and arguments on behalf of doing the right thing, regardless of who's in the White House or who's in Congress. So I come away with a lot of hope for what we can do in our lives, but we have to speak up. Thank you. I don't know how I'm doing on time. Okay, good.
We have plenty of time for questions. That was fantastic, Leo. Questions? Here we've got one from Pete.
Thanks, Leo. Fantastic talk, and also for giving us respite from slides. So I'm curious. I participated in this, but not nearly as deeply as you did. Thank you for leading it. It was awesome. I could imagine that the economics community, if there is such a thing, might have reacted kind of hostily to these conclusions. And I wonder if you could summarize the range of reactions you got.
Thank you, Pete. So, first of all, I should have declared up front, I am not an economist. That's going to sound a lot like I'm not a scientist. I am a scientist. But the fact that I'm not a formally trained PhD economist did not get in the way of our estimates at all. The economic community actually appreciated it. They actually argued that we had underestimated our dollar numbers. They argued that we didn't even consider ecological impacts, which some people would argue would put a zero to the right side of the dollar number such that it would multiply it by 10. But I don't think you need to multiply by 10 when you're looking at 2% of GDP. I'm sorry, I think that should be enough. Now, that's not a net benefits argument, but we are very transparent about that. We've gotten very little criticism from the economic community. Really, the debate has been on the epidemiology, on the human studies to inform the exposure-outcome relationships. And even there, there's, when you look deeply at the criticisms, often there are some conflicts of interest among other things that are at play in the criticism. So I would say that we've really gotten minimal criticism across the board.
Okay. We have a question over here.
What was the reception from the Europeans to the work?
Thanks for the question. There are always going to be political differences to begin with in the response, but it was quite warm. I've been asked a number of times to come before the various directorate generals. That's how they define their ministries across the European Commission. And the reception has actually been quite positive. The folks at OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development that the president is trying to undermine, all of their countries, which includes much more than Europe and the United States and Canada, have received it quite reasonably. I mean, they've understood that we've been super conservative. They've understood we've gone through rigorous peer review. And that really, we felt very comfortable coming away. We're really delighted that it was received with such warmth.
So really impressive results and memory. So you were quite conservative in the outcomes and in the chemicals that you included. Just here among friends, what do you think is the order of magnitude of the total underestimate from all these sources combined? Are we half too low, or what do you think?
I suspect we're 10 too low.
Ten
times too low. So we tried to do breast cancer. I hinted at that. It's tough. And that's the other thing. There's this long latency that we haven't talked about between exposure and disease. So you can fortunately take laboratory animals and get them through a one-year study and get to the third generation. In humans, that's 60 to 150 years, depending upon the generational cycle length, right? So that's the primal challenge. So there are a whole series, and you could add prostate cancer on that list, practically any of the cancers, not to mention the rare conditions like testicular cancer that emerges with a relatively shorter latency. So I think the one area that I will disclose that people have argued about and debated me till they're fiercely red in the face is about the way we've assessed probability of causation. We actually put the first stake in the ground about how to actually assess that. And sure, you can debate that. That was the one area where we could have overestimated, but if we overestimated, we overestimated by a factor of 20%, not tenfold the other way. So it tells you about the degree to which you could dispute our estimates south, but the north has a lot of room to go.
Yeah. Leonard, great work. And if you look at this historically through the lens of tobacco, okay, when obviously this plastics issue is much bigger than that. It's really a background risk for everybody, not just the people who inhaled tobacco, going back to the SG's report. One of the major tools that you're creeping up on here that was very useful was SAMMC, which, as you know, is smoking attributable morbidity, mortality, and economic costs. which is a tool that can be tailored for an employer, for a city, for a state, for whatever. And so I guess you answered a little bit in the last comment, the last question. How comfortable are you that we could develop a equivalent tool to this issue at this point? And even if it's not perfect, who would be interested in moving that ahead? Because that was very effective to move policy, was things like SAMAC.
Right.
Right?
It's a great point. And, you know, I just want to reflect a little bit on tobacco. One of the first people who talked about, so there's a little bit of a sidetrack, then I'm going to come back to your question. During the tobacco wars, this guy in the UK, Sir Austin Bradford Hill, set the landmark criteria for how you assess causality. And this is the other area where people get really uneasy. They say, well, you can't say something is causal. It either is or it isn't. Well, the person who designed causality back in the tobacco wars never said causality is either zero or one. He always described it as shades of gray, just the way that we did it and have presented it here. So I just want to make that point a little bit emphatically in that regard. To come back to your question about how do you measure it and can we extrapolate down to cities or companies or impacts at that level, the wild card here is that we don't have such refined measures of exposure across the United States to do that yet. Could we do that? Yes, but it would be really expensive right now based on the technology. And that's a theme that you've seen underneath here. If we had better, cheaper biomonitoring capacity to really measure these chemicals in the minute levels that we're detecting and that influence disease and disability, we could do that quite easily.
Thank you. We have one last question.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I wanted to build on the earlier question about to what degree is are these numbers underestimated, and to what degree is it possible to broaden the spectrum of financial impacts or economic impacts to, you mentioned briefly the impact on IQ, for example. So if we were to extrapolate from that, what does it mean for the future of our economy in the next 50 years to have the impact on IQ and to have perhaps less access to the innovation or solutions needed to solve a lot of what we've been talking about today? From an applied economics perspective, my guesstimate would be that we are off by 100x as opposed to 10x if we get to that level of thinking about the impacts. Long-term and more broadly than health, environment, and so on, or even human suffering?
It's a great question. Thank you. The answer to your question depends on having a sense of where the exposures are moving. Are they going up? Or are they going down? I mean, we've done studies seeing, and others have done studies seeing DHP drop off, but DINP and DIDP going up with the same effects of DIDP and DINP on insulin resistance and blood pressure that we've seen in kids that we saw before in the other populations where the exposure was DEHP. So it is this moving target. To use a rhetorical flourish that I use with my undergraduates about this, I go back to the phase out of lead in gasoline, where I tell them that by getting lead out of gasoline, my undergraduates have 15 micrograms per deciliter lower lead levels as kids than I did. I mean, I was a New York City kid in the 70s. And as a result, they're roughly 4 to 7 IQ points smarter than me from Go. So they actually should be teaching in class, not I. But the reality is that Scott Gross and his colleagues at CDC conducted a study documenting a $200 billion economic stimulus package that continues to this day as a result of the phase out lead in gasoline. Can we achieve something in endocrine disruption similarly? Yes. What frightens me, and this is the where I'm gonna pivot because you've stimulated me to think about it, is these exposures are moving to the developing countries. OECD suggests that actually the majority of chemical production has moved from the US and Europe and is about to be majority low and middle income countries by 2030. The chemical exposures in these countries are likely to skyrocket and we're likely to just repeat this. And we talk about how HIV, TB, and malaria have dropped off and how we've actually done a lot in global burden of disease, that we're going to see a second wave of chronic disease morbidity that's going to undermine those gains with the kinds of costs we're talking about here just being passed on to those countries as well. And I think Pete is going to jump out of his seat.
I think that last question and your response are particularly relevant to Pittsburgh as the plastic industry grows here in town.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Leo.
Thank you. Okay.